Guys, grab a Bible. Daniel 10, 11, and 12 are all leading up to the reality described in Revelation 12. So what's helpful to me is to make these connections in the Bible, because it helps me to read these passages to know, okay, when I'm reading Revelation 12, which in your, I don't know what it says in your Bible, but in my Bible, the heading is the woman, the child, and the dragon. And then there's this great kind of pageant that's displayed. Well, this pageant has a ton of meaning, but you would never catch the meaning unless you knew what it was talking about. And it's actually talking about the events described in Daniel 10, 11, and 12. So if you go with me to Revelation 12, verse 7, and it says, "And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought." And then there's this whole description of what's going on in the heavens and on the earth at the end time. Well, let's turn back to Daniel 10, 11, and 12. And I want you to actually just turn to Daniel 12 real fast. I just want to show you this connection because this will be important. If you go to Daniel 12, verse 1, it says, "At that time, Michael shall stand up, that great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble." That time of trouble is being described in Revelation 12. You see what I'm saying? So Daniel 12... actually, Daniel 10 through 12, because Daniel 10, 11, and 12 are all part of the same story that the glorious man is telling Daniel about this time. Revelation 12, and then Isaiah 34, Isaiah 24, Isaiah 28, these are all describing the same time period. So you could spend some time just looking at those passages and saying, how are they related? Like, are they talking about the same thing? So Daniel 12, Revelation 12. Isaiah 34 would be a great place to start right there. Just those three, because they're all talking about the same thing. And once I started to see these connections, it's like, oh man, this is actually a story that's easy to follow. It's not a bunch of disconnected, like, it's not a cookbook where you like find the Daniel 12 recipe and figure out what that's cooking, and then you go to Revelation 12 when you want a little variety. It's all talking about a story that's kind of continuous and comprehensive. And that's what we want. We want comprehensive understanding so that we know what's going on, because these things are actually all talking about very specific realities happening, in my opinion, right now. Okay? And Jesus, in Matthew 24, if we go to page one of the notes, if we could read, ladies, Matthew 24, verse 15.
"Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand."
So it's not like Daniel is kind of, you know, coincidental. It's in the Old Testament. Yeah, you could read it if you wanted to, but we really care about what Jesus said. Jesus said, understand Daniel. In fact, he was talking about the entire book of Daniel, not just like one thing that Daniel said. The entire book of Daniel, the primary subject matter is the abomination of desolation. The primary theme is God's sovereignty over the nations, over the Gentile kingdoms, okay? So item A on page one of the notes, just as Daniel 7, if you remember us studying Daniel 7, which was those four beasts that came up out of the sea, they were telling us about the political power base of the Antichrist, like the different empires that the Antichrist empire would kind of be built on. Daniel 8, it was describing the spiritual power base of the Antichrist, like the different spiritual realities of some of those empires. So if you remember, Daniel 7 is talking about the first thing that came up out of the sea was the Babylonian Empire, and then we see the Medes and the Persians come up, and we see the kingdom of Greece come up, and then we see this fourth beast that's unlike any other, which we kind of mined out one opinion is that it's the Islamic Empire. That's my opinion, that it's the Islamic Empire. Some people would say it's the Roman Empire. Well, Daniel 8 tells a story of a bunch of different empires, but the same idea. It's just the spiritual reality. So we saw the Medes and the Persians. We saw that go to the Greek Empire, and then the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies were the main spiritual dynamic describing the Antichrist. Okay, and that was the four kingdoms that came out of Alexander the Great's Grecian Empire. Well, tonight we're talking about Daniel 11. Daniel 11 is going to give us the tools that the Antichrist uses to try and manipulate the nations into his will. So Daniel 7, political power base. Daniel 8, spiritual power base. Daniel 11, same idea. We get a succession of empires, but it's talking about the tools, the forces that the Antichrist tries to employ to get people to do what he wants. Okay, so this is really important information. If you live in the time where you're like, you know, I think this might be the end times. Maybe there is an Antichrist or there's many. Like John said, there's many Antichrists. That's how I know it's the last hour. What would I look for if I was looking for an Antichrist? Now, my opinion is that most people that study the end times are looking for the entirely wrong thing. They're looking for a real bad guy who does real bad stuff. And if I compared him to Jesus, I'd be like, you're the bad guy, he's the good guy. But that's not at all what the Bible's describing about the Antichrist. The Antichrist, the anti in Antichrist means alternative to Christ. So the Antichrist, if I just look at him from a simply ends justifies the means, or the means justify the ends kind of paradigm, the Antichrist wants the same ends as Jesus Christ. He wants a renewed earth. He wants people to get along. He wants peace. He wants health care. He wants everyone to be protected in their bodies. He wants money distributed evenly. He wants it to be fair. Well, Jesus wants all those things. So if I'm looking for somebody who wants a bunch of stuff Jesus doesn't want, I'm not looking for the Antichrist. If I'm looking for somebody who wants the same things Jesus wants, he just wants them impatiently and in a humanistic power structure. That's the Antichrist. So it's very tempting to be like to Halloweenize the Antichrist. That's a really wrong approach. Daniel 11 has a ton of information about this. So I'm really excited actually to talk about it tonight. Okay, so Daniel 11 is a fascinating foretelling of history, just as Daniel 8 was. In fact, the main criticism of the book of Daniel, there's a couple of passages that most critics up until the 1940s used. And those passages were Daniel 8, Daniel 11 is such an accurate foretelling of history. Historians said there's no way that could have been written before it happened because the details are too minute. They're too minutely fulfilled, like the succession of kings and the way that it happened. We know a lot of the stories being described in Daniel 11, like the story of Cleopatra. That's one of the stories that's in Daniel 11. It was so minutely accurate that until the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, the main criticism was there's no way it could have been this accurate. But Jesus in Matthew 24, verse 15, what we just read, he said, Daniel's a prophet. So Jesus confirmed that was written by Daniel, and it was written prophetically. It wasn't written after the fact as an explanation of history. Did you ask something? Did you raise your hand? Oh, okay. Sweet. Okay, so you didn't know it. Verse 17 of Daniel 11 is actually describing Cleopatra. And she married a 10-year-old kid, and I've got the name of the king in here. And her the marriage was actually intended so that she would have influence over this Egyptian king so that her father could get influence in Egypt. But she actually really fell in love with the guy and didn't side with her dad, and it all backfired. And that's all described right there in that little verse. Verse 17. Now, Daniel, I should tell you on the front end, Daniel 11, verses 1 all the way to verse 35, you pick almost any Bible commentary, and they will agree that this history happened, and it's actually fairly easy if you know history to know who these passages are describing. So it's not like this is a bunch of controversial, well, some people think that, some people don't. You get to verse 36, none of verse 36 on has, in most people's opinion, has happened yet. I think we're actually living in the time of verses 36 through 45, but that's definitely end time unfulfilled stuff. Everything before verse 35, you're always going to find some outliers, but nearly universal agreement, commentaries you read will say this history settled. It's actually so accurate, it was the main criticism, that it was accurate. Okay, now Daniel 11, it spans all the way from Cyrus, king of Persia, that's 536 BC, to Antiochus Epiphanes. And we've spent actually a fair amount of time in the Daniel Intensive talking about Antiochus Epiphanes because he's the main picture of the Antichrist in the book of Daniel, especially in Daniel 8 and Daniel 11, okay? That spans a time period of about 400 years. So what I'm saying is from Daniel 11:1 up until Daniel 11:35, that's a 400-year span that's describing in that page and a half, okay? And then to the last days of this age, so we'd say, okay, if verses 36 through 45 are describing the end times, that's at least a time span of about 2,600 years. If we thought we're living in the end times, you know, the next decade or two, that would be about 2,600 years of that spans, okay? Now, the certain man, Jesus, as we talked about last time we were together, he says to Daniel that heaven has been orchestrating these events prior to Cyrus. Okay, so let's pick up in Daniel 10, verses 20 to 21. That's where we left off last time, and then we'll read all the way in to Daniel 11, 1.
Then he said, "Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince."
Okay, and then the very next verse is,
"Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him."
Okay, so it's important that we remember what happened when Darius the Mede became king. So Darius the Mede took the kingdom, remember, the fall of Babylon from Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the guy that like had all the temple utensils. He's having a party, the finger writes on the wall. And then Darius the Mede comes to power, and what the glorious man is saying is, "That was me. I was there. I stood up to confirm him and to strengthen him." And Daniel found a ton of favor with Darius the Mede. Now, Darius the Mede is also the guy that put Daniel in the lion's den. So Darius the Mede, he's a figure that the Lord is using, but he's telling Daniel something here. He's saying, look, the events that have led you to this point, my hand is behind all of them. I'm the one that's orchestrating these things. I'm sovereign over these guys. That's really important. Now, these chapters, they need to inform our picture of the Antichrist. Darius the Mede, he's one of the seven mountains that is a picture of what builds up to the Antichrist. So when we read in Revelation 13, Revelation 17, and John's shown like this beast coming up out of the sea. He's got seven heads. Then he sees like the woman. She's sitting on seven mountains. These seven mountains are the pictures of the Antichrist before. The guys who got delusional enough running a global superpower to actually demand people worship them. Darius the Mede was one of these guys, okay? But the glorious man says, I stood up to confirm him and strengthen him. So we've got to say, well, wait a second. Could God actually be okay with an Antichrist? And the answer is not only yes, but God raises them up for a very specific purpose, okay? So we want to understand that. It's important that our picture of the Antichrist is informed by the Bible, not that we inform the Bible of our ideas of what's good and evil. Our ideas of good and evil are the problem. That's what happened at the fall of man in Genesis 3. Adam and Eve were like, we'll eat some fruit, we'll tell you what's good and evil. That doesn't work. We've got to get our ideas of good and evil from the Bible, from God. Okay, so these chapters, they need to inform our picture of the Antichrist and how we see him. God made the Antichrist for a future and a hope. Now, we read last time we were together, we read in Ezekiel 28, the Lord talking through the prophet Ezekiel about Lucifer. And he says, you were made perfect in the garden, like you were made perfect among the stones. I can't remember exactly how the phrasing goes. But the idea is, all of the people in these passages, they have a choice. They have free will. And so God, he didn't make the Antichrist to rebel against him. He made him with the option to obey him. But he doesn't have to obey him, okay? And we don't have that. That should be sobering to us because we don't have to obey him either. We want to obey him. He gives us his Holy Spirit. We can listen to the Spirit. We can learn to obey him. That's really important because there's a lot of dignity on our choices. Okay, so God made the Antichrist for a future and a hope. God works all things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So even man's rebellion, God is using for the good of anyone who loves God and is called according to his purpose, like walks in the purposes of God. You don't have to worry about other people's rebellion is the point. As long as you stay steady in obeying God, other people's rebellion doesn't disrupt the plan God has for you. God is sovereign over all the kingdoms of men, including the Antichrist kingdom. He's completely sovereign over all of them. He could stop any of it anytime he wants. God uses the Antichrist to accomplish his purpose, which is to use the least intense means necessary to reach the greatest number of people at the deepest heart level without ever violating free will. Okay? I got that from Mike Bickle, and I really like the way he says it. Anti in Antichrist means alternative to. The Antichrist is a humanistic, or fleshy is another way to think about that. When we think about the word humanistic, maybe we don't use that word a lot. It just means fleshy. Like, the Antichrist wants to do the same things Jesus wants to do. He just wants to do it in the strength of man. And he thinks he's the guy to do it. And so he requires people need him. That's the worship that he's requiring. Okay? Because he thinks, I know more than anybody else about how to do this. The Antichrist is impatient. Okay, so I'm going to contrast and compare the Antichrist and Jesus for just a second before we get into Daniel 11. Jesus is patience. Okay, so Jesus' plan, it actually is intended to get us to be patient. The Antichrist operates in impatience. He likes things moving forward fast. He wants people to actually agree with him in impatience. And in fact, Isaiah 28, if you're taking notes, Israel's problem in the end times in making a covenant with the Antichrist is impatience. You can find that in Isaiah 28. Okay. Antichrist is manipulative / secretive. Jesus, he's not like that. He's open and clear and true. Antichrist tries to force things to happen. This is how you can tell the difference between Antichrist and Jesus Christ, okay? This isn't a complete list, a comprehensive list. Thank you. Antichrist tries to force things to happen, the same things that Jesus wants to happen in patience and in truth. Jesus refuses to force things to happen. In fact, it says that he won't break off a bent reed or quench a smoldering flax, but he will just remain in truth until everything bows to that. Antichrist believes appealing to people's natures, their natural appetites, sex, power, money, he believes that's profitable, that will work. Like, you just kind of common sense. If people are hungry for that, you give them what they're hungry for and lead them into the reality you want. He thinks that's good. Jesus teaches that the flesh profits nothing, and he appeals to the human desire for truth and for love. Now, that's a big difference, and we can actually watch for that right now. People who kind of say, you know, it's any means to the end. The end is what matters. What God wants to accomplish, that's what matters, and any means to that is good. That's Antichrist thinking. Jesus is like, no, the means are the ends. I can accomplish all the stuff. I want you to get into my way of living. That's the point. The means are the ends with Jesus, not the ends justifying the means. For the Antichrist, okay, I just said that. Matthew 16, 26. I really believed that. So I said it and I wrote it down.
You did. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?
Okay, so that's a clear theme throughout the Bible, actually, is that the means don't justify the ends. King Saul, great example of him thinking, you know, I'm going to accomplish what God wants, and I'll kind of do it my way. That's not okay with the Lord. He says that's witchcraft. Rebellion is his witchcraft. Daniel 11, 2, verses 2 to 36, they're telling the same story as Daniel 8, verses 2 to 12. Now, I'm not telling you that so that you can remember all of Daniel 8, 2 to 12 that we studied like 3 weeks ago, four meetings ago. I'm saying that so that if you're interested in this, go back and read Daniel 8, 2 to 12. It will inform Daniel 11, 2 to 36, and Daniel 11, 2 to 36 will help fill in some of the blanks for Daniel 8, 2 to 12. Daniel 8, talking about the spiritual realities driving these guys. Daniel 11, talking about what they do with the spiritual realities. Does that make sense? Okay, now its interpretation by Gabriel in Daniel 8, 20 to 25 is part of Daniel 8, 2 to 12. So Daniel 8, 2 to 25 is telling the same story as Daniel 11, 2 to 36. This is the story it's telling. The kings of the Medes and the Persians being succeeded by Alexander the Great. Him, very quickly after he conquers the entire known world, he dies at the age of 32, and his kingdom is divided up to his four main generals. Two of those generals are historically relevant, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. The other two kind of faded away really quickly. The Seleucid king, Antiochus Epiphanes, as the forerunner to the end-time Antichrist. All of these realities are in both Daniel 8 and Daniel 11. Daniel 11 begins with King Cyrus. He's the guy that's king when Daniel gets the revelation from the glorious man. And Daniel is told that there will be three more Persian kings. Okay, so that's where we pick up the story. Let's look at Daniel 11, verses 2 to 3.
And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will.
Okay, so the glorious man tells Daniel, look, I was there with Darius the Mede, all the kings of Medes and Persians. I've been a part of this, strengthening and I can't remember the word that he used, but putting them in place and then strengthening them. Then he says, right now, there's King Cyrus, three more coming after. Now, these three kings were Cambyses, and I give you the dates, Pseudo-Smerdis, Darius Hystaspes. Pseudosmerdis. That sounds like a funny name. Okay, and then Xerxes won. Okay, Xerxes won. He amassed great wealth. So if we go back up to that passage, through his riches, he'll stir up against the realm of Greece. What he did with all of his wealth was he gathered a huge army because he wanted to take out his main rival, which was the Grecian kingdom that was starting to grow. Well, that was a big boo-boo on his part, because what he did was he upset a guy named Alexander the Great. Greece was a bunch of divided city-states. Alexander the Great kind of unified them and led them against the Persian Empire in one. So when the glorious man is telling Daniel about these events, he stops at Xerxes. It's important that you know there were Persian kings that came after Xerxes. Xerxes was the dude that upset Greece and got Greece, Alexander the Great, to rise up. But it's all of this is describing a process. So it wasn't like Xerxes messed up and bam, he was gone. No, Xerxes messed up. Alexander the Great starts growing. Persians don't even really understand that for several kings later. And then Alexander the Great comes and crushes them. Okay, so that's important to understand the process that this is describing. Because a lot of times we read prophecy and we're like, we see these like really sharp dividing lines. Almost no prophecy operates that way. It's almost all a process. Like think about Jesus coming. The Pharisees, they're looking for like these really specific things that fit in their boxes. And then Jesus comes, he not only does he fill all the boxes, he blows them away. He's way more than anyone expected. And they don't recognize him because they've predefined like these very specific prophetic fulfillments that aren't real. Does that make sense? Okay. So Xerxes' invasion of Greece spurred Alexander the Great to action in unifying Greece into a global empire. Alexander, the mighty king of verse 3, he conquered the entire known world in approximately 10 years, and then he died at the age of 32. So Alexander the Great, lots of people know about him. He died really young. He was a really powerful king. At the time of his death, the kingdom of Greece was divided up by the four strongest generals of Alexander's army. We've talked about that a few times. I'll just remind you, the king of the north is Syria. The king of that's the Seleucids. The king of the south is Egypt. That's the Ptolemies. Okay, so if you see king of the north, Ptolemies, or Syria, they're all talking about the same thing. King of the north, Seleucids, or Syria, all talking about the same thing. Kings of the south, Ptolemies, or Egypt, that's all the same thing. They're two groups. What follows in verses 4 through 20 is an amazing foretelling of history regarding the kings of Egypt and Syria leading up to the picture of the Antichrist, Antiochus Epiphanes. The theme of these verses is the manipulation and force applied from each side. Okay, so if you're listening to me, look at me for a second. Okay. Syria, north of Israel, Egypt, south of Israel. Everything verses 4 through 20 is basically talking about a tussle back and forth between Syria and Egypt, and who's in the middle?
Us.
Israel. Yeah, Israel's in the middle, getting kind of lashed at as these two are actually really fighting each other. Israel's in the middle, and every once in a while they'll lash at Israel. The same thing is actually happening right now. There's a struggle right now between these same spiritual and political and military realities. And right now, there's one thing that's unifying Egypt and Syria. Does anybody know what that is? You just watch the news? Russia. Egypt is courting Russia, and Russia is courting Egypt in a massive way. This is a major spiritual reality, because Russia is typically aligned with Shia Islam, which Iran represents. A lot of the leadership of Syria would align with Shia Islam. All the people of Syria would align with Sunni Islam. Egypt is a Sunni Islam stronghold. So you've got a very weird spiritual dynamic happening right now. The Bible's telling us about this in Daniel 11. It's in the news right now, okay? So I kind of point that out as a taste of what's coming. What follows in verses 4:20 is a foretelling of the history of these two kind of fighting, leading up to the Antichrist. The theme of the verses is the manipulation and force applied from each side and how Jerusalem was caught in the middle. These kings tried desperately to control the Middle East and were willing to use a variety of means to gain that end. Page 3 of the notes. In the middle of all of this is what Jesus calls the glorious land. The glorious man calls Israel, the glorious land. Like, that's the way he refers to it. He loves the glorious land. Like, that's actually the thing that he's most concerned about, is like what's happening in the glorious land. We should be too. when we see Syria and Egypt and Russia and Iran and the United States getting in the mix and stirring it all up, we should be like, how is that affecting the glorious land? Right? And not so that she gets a man to give her all the things only God could give her, but how is she seeing Jesus as the one who is the cornerstone rejected, the Messiah, the one that we pierced, is the way it says it in Zechariah. They'll look on the one whom they pierced and mourn. Like, what are we thinking about and contending for that in the mix of all that, Israel would see that, not some human hero coming because he cares about a bunch of power structures all around Israel too? That's Antichrist. That's the way the Antichrist thinks. And I'm not talking about the current president. I'm talking about all the American presidents, the last three of them, at least, okay? Now, this means the Antichrist spirit uses these things. I didn't phrase item P very well.
Yeah. It means the Antichrist spirit uses.
Include. Yeah. Thank you.
It does make sense.
I wrote it well. I didn't read it well. Okay, so these are the things that these passages are describing. The reason I'm laying it out like this is because we're not going to take the time to read verses 4 through 20. They're talking about really settled history, kings that were kind of going back and forth. It's really interesting. We just don't have time. But this is what they're describing. Sex and arranged marriage, including the story of Ptolemy Soter's daughter. So if you look at verse 6, it describes... The daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north. Well, this history is like really settled. This is what happened. A guy named Ptolemy Soter, his daughter, Bernice, was married to Antiochus Theos. So an Egyptian king, he married his daughter off to a Syrian king who had to divorce his current wife, whose name was Laodice, in order to marry Berenice. It was just for political reasons. When the Egyptian king died a few years later, the Syrian king ditched the daughter of the Egyptian king that he married and took back his wife that he actually liked. But his wife got so angry at him for divorcing her to marry the Egyptian guy's daughter, she killed them both.
And the kids.
That's right. So Laodice became so enraged with jealousy that she had her husband. Now, the reason I point this story out is that the story of the Antichrist means and methods, it's like a soap opera. So we should be looking for this kind of reality in our time. Like, we'd be tempted to just kind of throw it all out the window and be like, it would never look like that. It's got to be like these kings and this power base. It's not like that. It's just like now. It's just people being selfish and crazy and manipulating people to get what they want and backfiring. Like, that's what this is describing, okay? Also, in verse 17, I mentioned before, it describes Cleopatra's marriage to 10-year-old Egyptian guy named Ptolemy Epiphanes. He was the king of Egypt in 197 BC. And again, her dad married her off to this kid, because he thought she'll be able to get a lot of control over him, but she fell in love with him. And she didn't help her dad out. She actually helped her husband out, and it frustrated her dad. And we could read about all this history, and then you can go to school and read about history, and it's talking about the same basic history. Okay, so sex and arranged marriage is one of the main tools that the spirit of the Antichrist uses to try and manipulate things into his way. Military violence, that shouldn't surprise any of us. The rising up of armies or brute force, that's a tool the Antichrist uses. Yeah.
China is wanting to get into the Mideast, and they're almost, what term they use was like buying Turkey.
Yeah.
So you want 200 million soldiers, you can get them in China.
Yeah. Now, China, and that's really important, actually, Tim. China is trying to get into the Middle East through Turkey. Turkey actually occupies what we're mostly calling Greece in this passage. Okay, so these spiritual realities, political realities, they're still in the earth right now. When you see Turkey, Turkey is most of the landmass is actually what we would call Alexander the Great's Greece. Okay, so that's that spiritual reality is still in the earth. Yeah.
Now, when the Bible talks about this information, talks about Asia Minor.
Yeah, that's Turkey. Exactly. Very good. Okay, so propaganda, stirring up of strife in verse 10. That's one of the tools the Antichrist uses is propaganda. He tries to, you know, says, however, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces. They stirred up trouble. They told some lies, got people all excited, and stirred up an army. This is one of the tools the Antichrist uses to try and get the same good things done on the earth that Jesus was. It's just the wrong means to the end. Does that make sense? Lying, verse 27. They just straight up lie to each other. These two kings, the king of Egypt, the king of Syria, they just sat at the conference table. They both sat there and lied at each other. We shouldn't be surprised if the kings of the earth right now just sit there and lie and then walk away. And they're like, hey, it's okay because I'm trying to help a bunch of people. These guys thought the same thing. They're really trying to help themselves. Okay, now religion. The using of corrupted religious zeal, specifically Jewish religious zeal, to break down strongholds between Syria and Egypt. It's a very specific manipulation of Israel in order to break down spiritual strongholds of Syria and Egypt. This is a theme that runs throughout the book of Daniel. And we just don't have enough time to develop all these things, but it's clear. And I'll give you a couple of verses just in Daniel 11 where it's happening. Financial manipulation. That's also described in these passages. Verses 7 through 19, if you're taking notes, you can later, this is what I did. I just write these guys in my Bible so I remember, okay, that's talking about Antiochus Magnus or Antiochus the Great. That's different than Antiochus Epiphanes. Verses 7 through 19 are primarily describing Antiochus Magnus, or another, he's also called Antiochus the Great, and his struggle against the Egyptian kings. Verse 20 is describing his son, Seleucus Philopater. He only ruled for a couple of years. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. Verses 21 through 35 are describing Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, and we're going to actually read about Antiochus Epiphanes because we've been studying him throughout our Daniel intensive. The reason that we study him is that the Antichrist is promised to have much of the same heart and characteristics of leadership. Antiochus Epiphanes, he's a usurper king. He's not even supposed to be king. His best friends, Tim pointed this out a few weeks ago, they called him Mad Dog. Yeah, did you want to say something?
Is he Seleucus, is that his son?
No.
Okay.
He's totally usurper. He's not even in the line to be kings. He snuck in there. And the way he did it, Angie, was he flattered people, and he was just a really charismatic kind of statesman-seeming guy, but he's really a weasel.
A weasel.
Yeah, okay. He's a pinch weasel. Okay, so Daniel 11, 21 to 35. And I'll probably interrupt you guys throughout this, okay? So just to set the tone, we're reading about the guy at the end of history. This history, remember we said it spans about 400 years. We're reading about the guy at the end of that 400-year history because he's going to set us up to start talking about the Antichrist. He's like the last picture before the Antichrist because it's almost like Jesus wants us that picture in our minds as we start talking about the end times, okay?
And in his place shall arise a vile person.
Okay, now that vile person is Antiochus Epiphanes.
To whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue.
So he seems like a real get-along guy. It's peaceable is actually used to describe him a few times.
With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away.
That they is Israel.
They shall be swept away from before him and be broken. And also the Prince of the Covenant.
Now that's a funny phrase, Prince of the Covenant. Most Bible scholars, this is not my knowledge, this is from commentaries. Most Bible scholars agree that's the high priest of that time. Because if you remember when we were talking in Daniel 8, what Antiochus Epiphanes did to get a hold in Jerusalem, he like made this side deal with a guy named Jason who wanted to be high priest, and they got rid of the actual high priest and installed Jason, who was very friendly to the Syrians, okay?
And also the Prince of the Covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully.
Okay, so that actually happened. Antiochus Epiphanes, if you remember, he made this deal with Jason, and then he required Jason to pay him money every year. And the guy who carried the money for Jason from Jerusalem to Syria, he decided on the way one day, I'll give him more. And then he made that guy the high priest.
And he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches.
What would we call that in modern terms? Redistribution of wealth or communism. Yeah, he's like, you guys come with me, we'll take their stuff and I'll give it to you. This is a common spirit right now in the earth.
Disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south.
Okay, who's the king of the south? Egypt.
Egypt. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and very mighty army.
Now, history minutely fulfills these. This is a prophecy that was given way back in Daniel's day in 536 BC. It was fulfilled about 400 years later in very minute detail.
With a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him.
So what's the moral of this story? All the flattery, all the promises, all the giving someone else somebody else's wealth in order to get them to be loyal to you, it's all based on you giving them stuff. And when they start not getting what they want, they're the ones that destroy you. All the people who ate his good stuff, they destroyed him.
His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down, slain.
But these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil.
So talking of the king of Syria and Egypt.
And they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper. For the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land.
Okay, now this is really, really important. The spirit of the Antichrist, he reacts to Israel in two different ways. In this way, what's moving his heart right now? Great riches, success. He got successful. He gets arrogant. It's an open door to Satan. Satan hates Israel. He kicks Israel on his way by. Okay? The kick is like a metaphor for he really messes it up.
At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and
okay,
do
now,
damage.
This time, he gets stymied. It's not great victory that gives him the attitude that goes after Israel. This time, he gets embarrassed. The spirit of the Antichrist, when it gets humiliated, goes after Israel also in order to elevate itself. The holy covenant, yes.
So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant.
Okay, and what that's describing is he takes advantage of Jewish people who are impatient and defiled. They're not doing things holy. They just want to do things expediently. He takes advantage of that. He shows regard for them. He's like, okay, I'll help you.
And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation.
Okay, so if you remember, we talked about all this happening in Daniel 8. This is all described in Daniel 8. It leads us up to the story of Hanukkah, which is the cleansing again of the Temple Mount after it's defiled by the abomination of desolation.
Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits.
Now that's God using all these things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. Resistance, it's making them strong, just like exercise makes us strong. God, he knows what he's doing.
And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering.
Now, are they dying because God's not sovereign over the situation? No. They're actually dying because he is sovereign over the situation. He's refining a people to go forward with him forever.
Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue.
Is that good? Is it good to join with Israel for selfish motivation? Is any means justify the ends? No.
And some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time.
Now, God, the point of all this is God is not trying to stop the Antichrist, just like he wasn't trying to stop Antiochus Epiphanes. God uses the desires and appetites of people in power to find out love and loyalty to God from the top all the way down to the bottom. This is the context where we choose our means. Trusting God with the ends. God's got the outcome. What matters is how we walk. We need to consider carefully how we will walk, and God will direct our future. Okay, now, item 2 on page 4 of the notes. The Antichrist plan to overrun the strongholds of Egypt and Syria. This is really the crux of what I want to talk about tonight, because this is actually unfolding right now. Egypt and Syria are the two strongholds being described in Daniel 11. So you keep seeing this term stronghold or fortresses. It's describing Egypt and Syria primarily. The primary focus is actually not Israel in most of this passage, even though it is the primary focus of the glorious man. But the focus of these two guys is mostly each other. You following me? Okay, now, And when I say these two guys, I'm talking about tons of kings that fall in Syria and Egypt. Verses 1 through 35 of Daniel 11 are widely understood to be fulfilled historically. Verses 36 through 45 are considered yet to be fulfilled. And like I said before, I personally believe we're watching the fulfillment right now. And I'm going to show you some news stories tonight that will kind of connect with some of these passages. Yes, I am. Noah is locked and loaded back there. The character and tools of the spirit of the Antichrist manifesting in powerful men. So we just talked about all those tools, you know, the means that he uses. Manifesting in powerful men who use Israel as a pawn in a power struggle that really centers on Syria and Egypt. That's what's laid out in verses 1 through 35. That's still happening to this day. Syria and Egypt are still incredibly politically and spiritually important. The verse 36 describes the end time maturing of this very same Antichrist desire, using Israel as a pawn in order to get the strongholds of Egypt and Syria to fall. The goal of the Antichrist is to be the one who brings peace and safety to the world, just like Jesus. Jesus is the Prince of Peace. He's going to bring peace. The Antichrist has a political plan to do that. Antichrist is the greatest political leader in his time. The false prophet, greatest Christian religious leader in his time. When those two are the like peanut butter and chocolate, they make a Reese's peanut butter cup. Peanut butter jelly. Yeah, there you go. Okay, now the goal of the Antichrist is to be the one who brings peace and safety to the world. Among the other promises, only Jesus can fulfill. And I give you some of those promises. Climate change. Jesus is going to restore the climate back to the Garden of Eden. Universal health care. He's going to resurrect bodies. Ending of poverty. Jesus is going to, some are going to be, some who are first are going to be last. Some who are last are going to be first. Jesus is going to redistribute wealth. Guaranteed. But he does it in complete righteousness and in truth. Now, Iran, we also call that Persia in the Bible. Syria, Turkey, which, like we said before, takes the landmass that is described as Greece in these passages, and Egypt are spiritual strongholds. Okay, so Iran, Syria, Turkey, and Egypt. Do you ever hear about these things in the news? There's a reason you're hearing about them in the news. There's a reason that these seem to be the strongholds of different ideologies in the Middle East. They really are. They're in the Bible as the strongholds. Okay, they present a physical problem to Middle East peace because they have differing views on what should be done in the Middle East. Middle East division literally spills over into global division in a very unique way. This is a spiritual reality. The entire earth is Jerusalem-centric. In fact, you could accurately say, even though in the news right now, if you listen, many people are starting to say the Temple Mount and the city of Jerusalem, they're not the primary conflict. Israel-Palestine is not the primary conflict. But for decades, everybody said it. Israel-Palestine is the primary conflict. Right now, there's a delusion that's going out in the world saying, and we don't even have to deal with that. We can ignore it. The reason that they're saying that right now is because Mahmoud Abbas is digging in and saying, I'm not going to talk about peace with anybody, even though it's very politically foolish for him to do that. And people can't figure out why won't this guy budge. But he's delusional. There's a bunch of delusion going on right now. Okay, but the primary political problem in the earth is the Israeli-Palestine conflict, and that's the Bible describes that. Now, the Antichrist is promised to enact a plan to break down the strongholds of power in Egypt and Syria involving a new, everybody say new, and violent, everybody say violent, religion. That's what the Bible's describing in verses 36 through 39. The Antichrist using a brand new and very violent religion to break down the strongholds of Syria and Egypt. Now the newest religion on the planet, well, I mean the newest major religion on the planet, is Islam. It was founded in 600 AD, 600 years after Jesus. Although the Antichrist will not subscribe to Islam, he will use it to break down the strongholds of Egypt and Syria, and the result will be an occupation of Israel by him, called the Siege of Jerusalem in the Bible. And you can read about that in Zechariah. Because the Antichrist will also, and not only Zechariah, but Zechariah really clearly lays it out. Because the Antichrist will also manipulate events in Jerusalem. Daniel 9, 26 through 27. We talked about that when we looked at Daniel 9, that the Antichrist tries to manipulate events in Jerusalem by brokering a covenant and then stopping the daily sacrifice. He's really involved in Jerusalem. Okay, does that make sense, what I'm saying? That the Antichrist, he won't subscribe to Islam, but he'll use Islam in order to break down the strongholds of Syria and Egypt. This is not my opinion. This is what the Bible says. What I'm saying is you can actually see this happening right now. Okay? Daniel 11, 36 to 39.
Good job. All right. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt him. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper until the wrath has been accomplished.
Now, the Antichrist, what this is saying is that the Antichrist, he is a godless man. He doesn't really believe anybody knows more than he does. So he exalts himself above all gods, although he's peaceable, like Antiochus Epiphanes. He uses the same manipulation, same flattery of the people of the covenant. Like, this is all set up for us to understand. It's going to be a little bit deceptive. In fact, that's the main warning Jesus gives in the New Testament. Do not be deceived. But the Antichrist, another thing you should be watching for, he'll get richer and richer and richer throughout the end times. Even though he's a political guy, he'll get richer and richer and richer.
He shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods and shall prosper until the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall neither regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god.
So what religion does he subscribe to?
None.
You'll hear some people say the Antichrist is a Muslim. The Bible is actually very clear that he couldn't be. The Antichrist is a humanist, but he uses the religions of the world. And the idea is this. He raises one up to get the other ones afraid to fight against the one so that he can make the claim, all religion is just like that one. We need no religion. He believes his theology is John Lennon's Imagine. Imagine no heaven, no hell, nothing worth dying for. That's his theology.
Nor the desires of women, nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place, he shall honor a god of fortresses.
Even though he doesn't subscribe to this god, he honors this god.
And a god which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain.
So this is what this is describing. The Antichrist, he sees a natural desire in this new religion to own these strongholds. It's a religion of fortress taking. And he's like, I can use that religion to knock down these strongholds. And then I can come in and accuse all religion. I don't like any religion anyway. And I'll get rid of all of it. And it'll just be sitting there like a duck for me to take and make peace in the Middle East. Now, in order to do this, he actually wants them to not just scare Egypt and Syria. He wants them to go in and divide the land and conquer it and actually rule over that land. Have we seen that at all in the earth since 2011? Have we seen parts of Syria and parts of Egypt given over to ISIS? We've seen ISIS actually dividing boundary, like literally dividing the land, stealing the resources, and then getting a great gain, only to be knocked right back down, and now there's a power vacuum in these places. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, now, in 2010, a very interesting chain of political events unfolded and resulted in the toppling or diminishing of three very specific Middle Eastern empires. Now, the reason that Syria, Egypt, Iran, and Turkey are important, they're spiritual strongholds. Remember when the glorious man meets Daniel and he says, I left as soon as you started praying. It took me 21 days to get here because the prince of Iran or Persia resisted me. Then the prince of Greece resisted me. These are very spiritual strongholds. Those spiritual kingdoms, they have proxy armies on the earth. There's a proxy war being fought in the Middle East. Who are the main tenders of the proxy war? Russia, aligning with Shia Islam, and the United States aligning with Sunni Islam, or the Western powers, you could say it probably more accurately, aligning with Sunni Islam. There is a fight going on, and it's very important that we understand that these countries are incredibly important in the Bible spiritually. So when we see a bunch of armies going after Syria or a bunch of armies amassing in Egypt or going after Egypt, there was a massive revolution in Egypt in 2012. Massive. And I want to explain that in the last 10 minutes that we have. Okay, so item J, the Arab Spring, which hopefully we've all heard about at this point in time, just being in the Daniel class. It began on December 19th, 2010. It was co-opted. This was a revolutionary movement that took hold in the Middle East, and it happened because of economic disparity. And a guy set himself on fire in Tunisia, and all of a sudden riots started breaking out all over the Middle East. The United States, very intentionally, very strategically, actually with the help of Google, and there's lots of articles about this, started to co-opt these revolutions and could take control of the social media that was getting people to gather together, and actually helped oust Hosni Mubarak very openly, the leader of Egypt. Then the United States, along with NATO, literally started bombing Muammar Gaddafi. I don't know why I put Al in there, but I don't think it's al-Qaddafi. I think it's just Gaddafi. They took him out. In fact, Hillary Clinton was on the news. She's like, "We came, he died." And she starts laughing. And we've seen that clip here, and I won't show it tonight. Then they started to go after Bashar al-Assad. What do these three all have in common? Mubarak, Gaddafi, and Assad? They were the only three secular leaders in the Middle East, and two of them were the leaders of these two strongholds, Egypt and Syria. Yeah, can you turn the projector on, Noah? Okay, so in September, December 19, 2010, the Arab Spring started. Within a couple of months, the United States co-opted in order to oust the secular leaders in the Middle East. Now, why did the United States want to do that? Because they wanted democracy in the Middle East. And these guys were not good guys. Hosni Mubarak, not a good guy. Gaddafi, it was a wacko. I mean, literally crazy. Bashar al-Assad, very brutal dictator. The Muslim Brotherhood is an organization in the Middle East committed to democracy. The Islamic Caliphate that we've been talking about in the past, it was a confederation of states, actually a form of democracy, just ruled by a different value system called Sharia law. The United States saw a partner. Now, it wasn't actually Obama that saw the Muslim Brotherhood as a good partner in the Middle East. It was actually George Bush, primarily, who saw the Muslim Brotherhood as a good partner because of access to different areas of the Middle East. Okay, Noah, are you ready to play video number one? No, that's not video number one. That is. There you go. So, Noah, can you turn the sound up on that?
Assad must go.
We both agree that Assad needs to go.
It is just further evidence that Assad has to go.
He is no longer legitimate and that he needs to go.
For the sake of the Syrian people, the time has come for him to step aside.
Assad is on his way out. We all need to be thinking about the day after Assad.
Assad has lost all legitimacy, that his time has passed.
President al-Assad has lost legitimacy, that he needs to step down.
As I have said many times before, Assad has lost all legitimacy, and Assad must go.
He has stated unequivocally that Assad has lost all legitimacy and cannot conceivably continue to govern.
Assad has lost all legitimacy to govern.
We've also been clear that Assad has lost all legitimacy to lead.
What we've done is organize the international community saying Assad has to go.
And I'm confident that Assad will go. It's not a question of if, it's when.
Okay, no, you can stop that one. Now, it's important to understand the context of this. This was the third leader that they were going after. What's wrong? Oh,
they
okay.
I mean.
Don't worry. Okay.
I thought we knew. We're not going to throw stuff in here.
Okay. Three leaders were deposed by the American administration, or three were attempted to be deposed. Al-Assad is still in power. Hosni Mubarak and Gaddafi were the first two. After those two fell, all the attention turned towards Syria. Okay, and that was in 2012, 2013. Now, we just watched the video of the government was basically unified in saying the point is getting rid of these thugs in the Middle East so that democracy can flourish. Now, as we discussed in week 9, this is very similar to what is described in Daniel 7 regarding the Antichrist political power base. So before we read this, we're going to read Daniel 7, verse 8, which I'm referring to in item K. But what President Obama was saying was, I've gathered a coalition of the nations in order to deal with Assad. That coalition included 10 very specific Middle Eastern countries. It was called the 10-Nation Arab Coalition. Now, that should really pique our interest. We talked about this when we talked about the 10 horns, because the Bible prophesied that that would happen. There would be 10 smaller kings that would want to partner with a larger government and be kings for 1 hour with that larger government. So let's read Daniel 7, verse 8, which describes what happened with that confederation.
I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there, in this horn, were the eyes, like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words.
Okay, so after these events, the U.S. withdrew from Iraq. Once this 10-nation coalition was assembled, and these three horns were basically being pulled up, the United States withdrew from Iraq, which allowed Sunni resistance movements, which al-Qaeda in Iraq was the name of one of them, to begin taking over Iraq and the eastern portions of Syria. ISIS was birthed in the winter of 2014. There was no such thing as ISIS before the winter of 2014, because ISIS was really a bunch of disparate fighters, including some Free Syrian Army guys. They were mostly Muslim Brotherhood Sunni guys. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, we pulled out of Iraq, and there were a ton of weapons that we had put into Iraq. Okay, and a very violent expression of Islam began breaking down the fortress of Syria. On September 11, 2014, the president came out and had announced that he had organized this 10-nation Sunni Arab coalition to fight ISIS, which the U.S. actually enabled the creation of just 3 years earlier by withdrawing troops from Iraq. And I give you the list of the nations that made up this 10-nation coalition. Now, some of them are Shia, some of them are Sunni. If you know anything about Islam, you know Sunni and Shia Islam, they hate each other. So we're trying to put something together. Now, the Bible, remember when we talked in Daniel 2, it described that last empire as being like iron and clay. They don't really mix, okay? And it's starting to fall apart. That's the point. The iron and clay falling apart, that's what we're going to read about in Daniel 11, 40 to 45. But Daniel 36 to 39 describes why it falls apart, because a very violent religion was used in order to take down the strongholds of Syria and Egypt. Okay, so let's watch video number two, Noah, which is that one. Yep. We've watched this one before, too. I'm just reminding you.
In the Middle East, 10 Arab nations pledged to join Washington's fight against Islamic State militants. Retired U.S. Marine General John Allen is said to be coordinating the efforts in Syria and Iraq. Our Konzoa has this story.
President Obama's broad coalition of U.S. allies to counter Islamic State militants is gradually taking shape. 10 Arab nations, including Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Egypt, and Lebanon, have vowed to support the international coalition, which aims to ultimately destroy the extremist group. This pledge came on Thursday at a meeting of the nation's foreign ministers and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in the Saudi coastal city of Jeddah. Kerry stressed the critical role Arab nations play in the joint communique. They will have to provide military support, humanitarian aid, and ensure the flow of funds and foreign fighters to IS is cut off.
And certainly the effort to repudiate once and for all the dangerous, the offensive, the insulting distortion of Islam that ISIL propaganda attempts to spread throughout the region and the world.
Okay, Noah, you can stop that video. I want to point out that the countries that were assembled to fight ISIS, they've mostly wanted Bashar al-Assad gone. What ISIS was doing was fighting against Bashar al-Assad. It's actually a major conflict of interest geopolitically over the last several decades that they would align, and even with the United States, who kept saying Bashar al-Assad must go. Well, that's what ISIS was actually doing, was trying to break down Bashar al-Assad's empire. They weren't coming after the United States. They were coming after Bashar al-Assad. They weren't really even fighting that much the Free Syrian Army. What they wanted to get rid of is that stronghold of Bashar al-Assad, which they see as a corruption of Islam. Then they'll deal with all the other infidels. But what they wanted first, if you watched ISIS, what they mostly did was attack religious sites, a lot of Islamic religious sites, and break them all down, because they are purists, ideologues for Islam. The United States knows that, and so does the other coalition of nations. Now, Dara in Syria, where the Arab Spring Revolution began in Syria, it literally means fortress. The U.S. allied Free Syrian Army, they just lost Dara back to Bashar al-Assad's Russian-backed regime on July 12th of this year, like a few weeks ago. In 2011, the United States partnered with Qatar. So if you look at this list of 10 horns, Qatar, that Sunni Islam state, back in 2011, when all this started, the U.S. partnered with Qatar, who is very friendly with Iran. That makes them very unique in Sunni Islam. They have very close economic ties with Iran and a state sponsor of the Muslim Brotherhood. Qatar is the owner of the Al Jazeera network. They actually own a TV station. The United States was very, very friendly with Qatar under the Obama administration because they were a mouthpiece of the Muslim Brotherhood, who we were backing to bring democracy to the Middle East, only it's Islamic democracy. It's what you hear called political Islam. If you watch like CNN or Fox News, you hear a guy named Judy. Remember that guy's name? There's an Islamic kind of spokesman, and he's always talking about political Islam. We need political Islam, not religious Islam. I can't remember his name all of a sudden, but political Islam means the same thing as the Muslim Brotherhood. As is developed in the 10-nation Arab coalition designed to fight ISIS. Okay, so the Muslim Brotherhood was the main kind of glue between this 10-nation coalition. Also called, another term you might hear in the news is the GCC, or Gulf Cooperative Council. The 10-nation coalition is basically the GCC, not exactly, but very close. In May 2017, so the Obama administration really partnered with Qatar. In May 2017, the United States broke that partnership and sided with Saudi Arabia, a chief enemy of Qatar, an arch nemesis of Qatar, and a sworn enemy of Iran. Saudi Arabia and Iran are arch enemies. The United States did that, flipped the switch, and went with Saudi Arabia in order to rebuild terrorist fighting alliances in the Middle East. If you remember, the President Trump had his hand on the little orb, and then it all lit up, and they had all this bank of computers, and they said, this is the new network that's going to find all the terrorists. Well, a lot of them are the terrorists. Like, they're backing the terrorists. Like, this is kind of crazy, unless you understand it from a biblical standpoint. What's going on? They're trying to break down the strongholds of Syria. And if you listen to the current president, he also wants to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. He also has a big problem with Hosni Mubarak. Hosni Mubarak has insulted the president of the United States twice now, and it's made him very upset. Egypt and Syria are very much on the radar of the United States. But at the same time, Egypt, very uniquely in all of history, is making a massive political alliance with Russia. In fact, Russia is building an air base in Egypt right now to fight ISIS in Libya. Libya and Egypt share a border, and ISIS keeps encroaching on Libya's border, or on Egypt's border. Egypt invited Russia to come and fight ISIS, just like Russia fought ISIS in Syria. Do you see what I'm saying? Yes. This is all intended to break down these two. But the Bible is very clear. The collateral damage is going to be Israel, and it's going to be an occupation of Israel, okay? So let's watch the next two videos. Video number three, Noah.
Yeah.
The rapidly developing relations between Russia and Egypt have been overshadowed by the more prominent relationships between Russia and Syria.
This was recorded in 2016, before President Trump came to power.
The Russia-Egypt relationship deserves a closer scrutiny because, unlike the country's relations with the other two Middle Eastern powers, it concerns a country that, until recently, appeared to be firmly in Western orbit.
That's Mohamed Morsi, the leader of Egypt, former.
Eurasia therefore represents a far bigger change for the region than Russia's successful support of the legitimate Syrian government or the close relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran, both of which have been on the Western enemies list for decades. The reasons for this shift are twofold and have to do with the way Western powers interact with Middle Eastern powers in the context of a systematic economic crisis, as well as with Russia's demonstrated attractiveness as an ally. The West's systematic crisis clearly transformed how Western powers view non-Western ones. Whereas the end of history, a globalist rhetoric suggested a post-sovereignty utopia in which weak and strong partners interact on equal terms in a world without borders, in practice that rhetoric was a ruse to persuade non-Western powers to drop their guard and allow themselves to be penetrated by Western corporations and financial institutions and lose any possibility of charting their own independent course. Egypt, a longtime Western ally since the late 1970s, unexpectedly found itself on the receiving end of predatory Western policies, which took the form of the Tahrir Square color revolution, which ultimately led to the electoral victory of the Muslim Brotherhood, which in turn fell to a military overthrow once the danger of the country's slide into the civil war became apparent. The fact that the Muslim Brotherhood was financed by U.S.-aligned Persian Gulf states made Egypt aware it too was the target of state-sponsored jihadism, and that the U.S. was incapable or unwilling to force its allies in the region to refrain from targeting Egypt. While Syria is only a peripheral concern for Egypt, the civil war in Libya, where Islamist formations including...
See the little white in between Syria and Egypt? That's Israel.
Can be used as a staging ground for launching attacks into Egypt and a sanctuary against retaliation and, longer term, should its government be a puppet controlled by hostile Gulf powers whose long-term goal is the control of Egypt and the Suez Canal, which means that Cairo is keenly interested in influencing the outcome of that war. Russia thus became an attractive partner because of its history of non-involvement in the internal politics of its allies.
Can you pause it for a second, Noah? To a fault because what that's saying... in just layman's terms, is that Egypt saw this all going down and thought to itself, Russia is our best bet to survive all of this manipulation going on in the Middle East. This is in 2016, before Trump became president. You can start again, Noah.
This unilateral restraint led to the Maidan revolution in Ukraine because it can fill the security void left by the Western weakness, and last but not least, because it can physically defend Egypt's political and territorial integrity against every conceivable threat, an ability it is currently demonstrating in Syria. Egypt appears to be taking advantage of these capabilities. Cooperation now includes the possibility of establishing a Russian airbase in Egypt,
which has since happened,
by Russian paratroopers to Egypt and special operations troops providing training to their Egyptian counterparts. Egypt is also shifting its military procurement plans towards Russia. The two Mistral class ships that have been acquired by Egypt will receive the originally planned Russian electronic suite and will carry Russian helicopters. There are discussions of MiG fighter sales to Egypt, and the country received a Munir class missile boat.
Now
from the Russian perspective, Egypt represents yet another bulwark of security against Western encroachment. A symmetric response to NATO expansion, Eastern Partnership, and color revolutions. Combined with the military presence in Syria, Cyprus's general pro-Russian orientation, and the neutralization of Turkey, which was also facilitated by an abortive West-promoted coup attempt, Egyptian bases would transform Eastern Mediterranean into a Russian lake.
Which is important because ships are going to come from Cyprus.
...pad for power projection into other unstable areas of the Middle East, and if Egypt's control of the Suez Canal is guaranteed by Russian arms, this guarantee endows both countries with a very effective means of pressuring Western and Gulf Arab powers.
Okay, Noah, you can turn that one off and get ready to do the next one. Now, this was the political reality that was happening in 2016, which is actually... pretty clearly associated with what we've been reading about. In 2017, even though these things were all happening and people knew about it, what the current president did was basically take that hornet's nest in Russian and Egyptian involvement growing, and he just shook it really hard. So, no, let's play this last video. We won't listen to the whole thing.
...predicted President Trump's position on Qatar during the Gulf States' ongoing diplomatic crisis.
Now that it's been more than 2 weeks since the embargo started... we are mystified that the Gulf States
are not
released to the public, nor to the Qataris, the details about the claims that they are making toward Qatar. The more the time goes by, the more doubt is raised about the actions taken by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. At this point, we are left with one simple question. Were the actions really about their concerns regarding Qatar's alleged support for terrorism, or were they about the long-simmering grievances between and among the GCC?
Okay, now I'll pause this for a second. So this lady is from the State Department, the United States State Department. What she was doing is she was explaining to the world the State Department's position on Saudi Arabia and the other 10 nations that were part of that Gulf coalition. They started boycotting Qatar last year, last summer. When the president went and picked Saudi Arabia to be the new Middle Eastern partner, they all isolated Qatar, which was the Obama administration's favored one. And the State Department was explaining that they didn't understand what was going on, not realizing that at the same time, the president had an entirely different take on it. Let's finish just the next couple minutes, or next couple seconds. No.
The time had come to call on Qatar to end its funding. They have to end that funding. And its extremist ideology in terms of funding. The nation of Qatar, unfortunately, has historically been a funder of terrorism.
But even Trump himself's been sending mixed messages as he sold $12 billion worth of fighter jets just 5 days after lashing out at Doha's terror funding. Well, to discuss this further, I'm now joined live...
Okay, no, you can stop that one. And that's it for videos. So I mostly just wanted to see the news clips and the actual quotes of the officials, not so much the spin, because it's hard to find these news stories in American media. You actually have to go to very biased media to find them, but they're real things that are happening, okay? So I want to end right here on page 6. The Bible is clear that a situation similar to this, what we just watched, will result in a regional war that begins what Daniel is told is a time of trouble unlike any other. That's the time when Michael stands up. That's that Revelation 12 time. This coincides with the breaking apart of the 10-horn Antichrist coalition. The whole time of trouble, the regional war, what it is the 10 horns that were gathered together. They only gather together for 1 hour. They rule for 1 hour. Then they turn and burn the harlot, who is the Antichrist country, with fire. And what we're seeing is actually a very unstable alliance of people who really don't get along that good, like iron and clay, right now in our day, breaking apart as the fortresses of Syria and Egypt are being pummeled by the two major world powers. This is the same thing that's being described here. Okay, so I want to read... I want to go down to Daniel 11. So Revelation 17, 12 to 18, that, I give you that passage because that's where you hear about the 10 horns actually flipping on the Antichrist. Like, they don't stay with him. It's only really quick, and it's like iron and clay mixing. With just a little bit of a push, it all breaks apart. And then all those 10 coalition members, they jump inside with the enemy of the one who gathered the coalition. That's the point. That's what's happened throughout history, and it's happening right now. These countries are aligning with Russia because they're aligning with Iran, who is a proxy of Russia, and they're aligning with Egypt, and they're aligning with Syria. So you need to take this information and watch the news. Is this happening? Is some of these Middle Eastern countries that were previously allied with us, are they suddenly going to Russia? Is Russia's influence growing in the Middle East? And what does the Bible say about that? Okay, so we're going to end right here, Daniel 11, 40 to 45.
At the time of the end, the king of the south...
That's Egypt.
...shall attack him...
The Antichrist.
...and the king of the north...
That's Syria.
...shall come against him like a whirlwind.
The Antichrist. They both attack not each other, but the one who stirred up the hornet's nest.
Like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he
now,
go ahead.
You should ask yourself, how does Syria and Egypt attack this guy with many ships? They don't really even have that many ships. But you just saw in that video... They have a friend from the north and from the east that's got a lot of ships.
And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through.
That's talking about the Antichrist. So the Antichrist, he gets freaked out when they attack him. They attack him in a small way. He brings the biggest army on the planet to wipe them out.
He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown.
Now, why does he enter the glorious land? We read from other passages, because he feels as the Antichrist that it's his job to be like Jesus Christ and protect Israel. For her own good, he enters the glorious land. He lays siege to Israel because he thinks Israel is the problem for the whole thing anyway. And he thinks he's going to protect her, and then he actually lays siege to her, and he demands that she listen to him and then demands that she worship him.
But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon.
That's all describing Jordan.
He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels.
So when he goes in and he gets Egypt, then he's got Libya and Ethiopia starting to come after him at his heels.
But news from the east and the north.
That's Iran and Russia.
Shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him.
Let's go ahead and read that last verse.
At that time, Michael...
At that time, when that regional war breaks out, and Egypt and Syria are suddenly aligned with each other against the same enemy, and that enemy has a much bigger army and goes in and starts having his way in the Middle East, and then Russia and Iran stand up. Can you see this, like, being set up right now? That's the point I'm trying to make. Like, the world is, for the first time since Israel became a nation in 1948, Israel has to be a nation for these things to happen. Israel became a nation after 2,000 years of not even existing, and these political realities started to emerge, and we're living in the maturity of them right now. Right now. And we're supposed to understand that's the time that Michael stands up. So if you go back to the last time we were together, what makes Michael stand up? A praying church. That's the point. When the church sees these things, the bride, the people who really love Jesus and really know, they know the word. Remember, we read about them. They'll do great exploits. They'll be refined. They'll become purified. Some of them will die, but they will. This is the time that they become the most like Jesus. That's the point. We're seeing all these things happening right now. So the question we need to ask ourselves is, are we responding? Are we seeing this as a time to intercede? To intercede for the real reality of Israel, seeing Jesus as glorious, not getting a guy to come and help her, but to see the cornerstone rejected, the one whom she pierced as desirable and mourning her. Is that what our lives are about? Because he's coming in this time to gauge what our lives were actually about. And the promise of the Bible is most people, it'll be like as in the days of Noah. They'll buy, sell, plant, married, given in marriage until the day the flood comes. And they won't even know. They miss the time to get in love with what God is doing right now. Michaela, will you come up? Yep, I do want her to finish it.
At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book.
That's describing all of Israel being saved. That's the point of this time in world history. When we see the nations gathering against Israel and for Israel, and the strongholds of Syria and Egypt being prominent in the news, and all this military might and all this manipulation, this political manipulation, the soap opera of many world leaders in the news right now. And we're supposed to know this is the time that the believers are going to gather together and pray, that Israel is actually going to see Jesus as the Messiah through all of these events. You can go ahead. I'm going to say some things while you're playing.
Got it.
I'm going to pray for you guys. I just want to read this last, right after what Jen read, I'm going to read two more verses. This is the promise over us. If you'll stand with me. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. We don't want to awake to everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. That's the point, to be a people that turn others to righteousness. That's why we care about righteousness. Because we care about getting ready for Jesus to return. The ends, they're going to take care of themselves. What matters right now are the means of finding safety, the means of finding peace, the means of finding provision. He'll take care of it. He'll take care of the safety. He'll take care of the peace. He'll take care of the provision. But how are we going about positioning ourselves for these things? Because it's going to matter forever. It's going to matter in a billion years. Some will be raised up to glory. Some will be raised up to shame and contempt. So if you want to be raised up to glory, if you want a vision, if you just want understanding, you want to see the politics happening all around you in the context of the Bible, I just believe there's a grace for that tonight. That happens by praying. It doesn't happen by studying. It happens by praying. The Holy Spirit reveals this stuff. He revealed it to me, and I don't have it all down, obviously, but it's the Holy Spirit that unveils this stuff. Jesus, he's talking to Daniel. This isn't just Daniel studying the books. He's having an encounter with the Lord that we're still gleaning from. If you want that, I just want to pray for you. Holy Spirit, just respond to him. Just raise your hand or take a step forward. Just tell him with your own words, Jesus, I want to understand what's going on all around me. Jesus, I'm asking, would you come? Would you speak to us? I pray even tonight, would you give us dreams and visions of who we are in this time? Could we be the ones, Lord, that just tell the truth with clarity? Can we be the ones, Lord, that teach others righteousness because we go after it ourselves? We ask for forgiveness. We're generous. Lord, we forgive those who use us, who lie about us. Lord, would you give us vision for how worth it is to act like you, Jesus, just to try to pray, help me to forgive. Help me, Lord, to operate in the gifts of the Spirit. Help me with patience If you need patience tonight, I just feel like that's what the Lord, he really wants to impart that. Just tell him, I need patience, God. If you want forgiveness, just tell him, I need to learn forgiveness. Holy Spirit, right now in this room, touch us. Touch us with your glory. I just pray for that sensation of your presence, Lord, that just gives us confidence that you're here. Right now, all over the room, just touch us. Empower. As we worship you, Lord, let us feel your nearness in Jesus' name.
Call my name and I will come right back to you.